Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 2nd, 2012. Superstorm Sandy will cost an estimated $50 billion for cleanup and repair, and it could cost you too if you're not careful.
The most prevalent type of fraud that takes place after a disaster are the fraudsters who go after the very charitable inclinations of the American people, supposedly for disaster relief.
Plus, we'll review some of the big financial issues affecting Americans as they head to the polls.
Today, 47 million people are on food stamps.
If he wasn't on Medicare, not only would it bankrupt him, but it'll probably bankrupt us as well.
Most Americans have less than $100,000 in their 401ks.
I have nothing except my pride, and I'm not afraid to say that I take advantage of every program out there that I can get my hands on for a disabled individual.
We used to know how to help the middle class, and one way was to actually pay them reasonably well.
It's on Marketplace Money from APM.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
Superstorm Sandy's toll rose throughout the week this week, both in cost and in lives. For many people, the damage is incalculable. They lost their homes. They lost their businesses. It is nothing short of yet another national tragedy caused by nature's fury. Disasters like this leave us vulnerable, and it's at those times when we are also most susceptible to fraud. Scam artists are already thinking up ways to prey on people dealing with Sandy's after effects. Here to talk with us is Professor Bill Cressy. He directs the Center for the Study of Fraud and Corruption at St. Xavier University. Welcome.
Great to be here.
First of all, for those affected by Sandy, what kind of potential fraud should they be looking out for right off the bat?
You know, just as there's a rainbow after every storm, there are fraudsters that are attracted to every disaster. And just as there are many colors in the rainbow, there are many frauds that take place. And the first one is the contractor fraud, people who will try to get you to sign a contract. And of course, what they're interested in is a big cash payment up front
right.
to do work that may never get done or is done shoddily or done with poor materials. Another one that they should be prepared for is being approached by folks who will supposedly aid them in getting federal money. The federal government has a lot of workers out there. Additionally, the insurance companies are flooding the region with claims adjusters. But there will be those who will come forward and say, oh, if you come to us, we will get you additional money. We will help you through the process if you pay us so much up front.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's the payment up front that's always the tip-off. A contractor may request a small amount up front just to get the initial materials to start the work, but they're not going to ask for big payments up front. This is a time where you lean on that insurance company. Especially if you got a mortgage, you would have had to have homeowners insurance on your property. If you lived in any of the designated areas, you would have had flood insurance as well. And you've been paying those premiums for so long, now's the time to lean on them. Now's the time to take advantage of them.
What about the rest of us who are watching what's happening from the outside and maybe want to donate, want to help in some way? Are we vulnerable as well?
Oh, yes, we are. In fact, probably the most prevalent type of fraud that takes place after a disaster are the fraudsters who go after the very charitable inclinations of the American people, who will be sending out massive emails and even telephone calls. And I've even seen cases where they'll go door to door trying to collect money supposedly for disaster relief. And these folks will go in the name of existing charities, or they'll even make up sound-alike charities. They'll create a URL for a charity that doesn't exist except in their own imaginations, but with a URL a web address that sounds a whole lot like a legitimate charity. And the money just goes straight into their pockets. I mean, there are plenty of wonderful charities out there who are in there right now doing the work, whether it be the Red Cross or the Salvation Army, Catholic Charities, Samaritan's Purse. Go to them directly and make sure you get them. But the biggest and, as I say, most prevalent fraud that takes place following a disaster is going for the non-victims of the disaster and trying to get you to contribute to a charity that doesn't really exist.
You know, I remember there were a lot of similar problems to what you've described here involved with the relief effort after the earthquake in Haiti. And of course, we've had several disasters even since then. Have we really not gotten any smarter about avoiding these things?
No. We haven't got any smarter with the mechanics of avoiding it. And just to add another spin to the whole thing is, in addition to the donation that they're seeking and spending that money, how are you going to give that donation? Well, you're going to give them either a credit card number or a checking account number and some other information that is going to be used to steal your identity. So in addition to the $100 donation that you thought you gave to the Red Cross, but it actually went to a phony fraudster front, you are giving a credit card number, which they're going to run up in the next day, and you'll be left holding the bag.
I guess the real lesson here is that for all of the coming together and the compassion that is shown in the aftermath of something like this, there just will always be people who try to take advantage. And I suppose, to quote the old journalism trope, if your mother tells you she loves you, check it out.
That is something that I quote to my students in my fraud examination MBA program.
Oh, there you go.
that whenever they're told something, they got to check it out. Fraud never sleeps. There are going to be those who are going to try and take advantage of a situation. And it's about 5% of the population who are willing to do whatever it takes to take advantage of another person.
Wow.
So that's a significant number of people out there who are willing to rip you off. So we, the other 95%, must constantly be vigilant and be ready and be sadly skeptical, even in these times.
Professor Bill Cressy is director of the Center for the Study of Fraud and Corruption at the Graham School of Management at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Thank you so much for your help today.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Now, many, if not most of us, are watching the events unfold from Sandy and saying to ourselves, there but for the grace. Well, are you ready financially for something like this to come to your doorstep? In a couple of weeks, in partnership with the New York Times, we'll be talking about how to bulletproof your finances. What is your secret to financial security? Let us know on Facebook, on Twitter, or at marketplace.org.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
The pictures this week have been horrifying. Water everywhere, sand in the streets, houses washed away, the lower half of Manhattan plunged into night after night of darkness. The images have also shown us people swarming grocery stores, snapping up emergency supplies, and fighting over electrical outlets and gasoline. These are clear signs of neighborhoods in crisis, but disaster is also an opportunity to strengthen communities. Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He joins us now to talk about how we behave when crisis strikes. Welcome.
My pleasure.
So we've heard stories this week about people pulling together, helping each other out, and I'm sure we'd all like to think of ourselves as folks who would behave that way when a disaster occurs. But how long does that altruistic feeling and activity tend to last?
So I think it tends to last quite a long time, and for two reasons. One is that people get to realize how much they depend on other people in such cases. And the second thing is that this is the emerging social norm. So if you think about it, how do you know what's the right behavior? What we usually do is we look at around us and we see how other people are behaving, and we take that as a signal for what appropriate behavior is. And I think given all the nice cases of how people are treating each other so nicely, there's a good chance that other people would watch it, would look at this as the standard norm, and would actually keep on behaving this way. The problem, of course, is that a nice social coordination can very quickly collapse. So if you think about something like riots at soccer games, you know, people are basically behaving nicely, And then all of a sudden, one person behaves badly and things start deteriorating. So I think the same thing could happen here, where right now the social norm are quite positive. But if people would start behaving incredibly selfishly, there's a chance that this would deteriorate.
Most people, as we know, are simply aren't prepared for a disaster. So one of the first things that they do is they go out and buy as much water and canned tuna and maybe gasoline as they can. I wonder what kind of problems can arise when everyone is fighting over scarce resources, and how does that affect a community?
So when we did an experiment a long time ago in which we walked around the lab and we offered people chocolates, and these were very nice pieces of chocolate, and we wanted to see how many people would take. And what we saw was that everybody just took one piece. A few people took two. Nobody took more than two. People took either one or two. And in another condition, we offered them for sale at a reasonable price. And now what happened is that all of a sudden, many people wanted to buy everything we had in stock.
Huh.
And the same thing I can imagine happening here. So imagine a supermarket where they're selling water at a particular price versus imagine a community center in which you can come and get water. The prediction is that in the supermarket, the first people would show up would say, hey, this is a commercial world. This is the price of water. Let me get as much of it as possible. But in the second world, where it's a community center, they would say, yes, it's true that I've arrived early, but there are other people who will probably arrive later. Let me think more carefully about what I really need.
We also quite often hear post-disaster about store owners, retailers jacking up their prices. But it doesn't seem like we've heard much about that this time around. Any speculation why that might be?
I think everybody feels like they're in the same boat. You know, so sometimes when disasters happen, store owners decide to take advantage of it and jack up prices. And people, of course, are really outraged. I think in this particular case, the tragedy is so large, everybody feels connected to it. Everybody is suffering to some degree, and taking advantage of your fellow men who are in the same boat probably feels much worse than taking advantage of other people who are you don't feel as connected to.
We've been talking about behavior in the immediate aftermath of a disaster like this, but I wonder long-term effects on a community. You know, once a place like the New Jersey Shore has been identified as so vulnerable to a disaster like this, do people in general tend to get up and leave?
You know, I don't know. I remember when I was a kid growing up in Israel, I would often see things in the U.S., all kinds of disaster, hurricanes and so on, and I would see people who build their homes in the exact same spot that the wind just took their home from.
Yeah.
And it used to amaze me how come people don't leave. And I think the case is that people don't leave. If people feel connected, it's their friends, it's their family, they feel perhaps even more connected to the place after the disaster. After all, it has more memory and more ideology connected to it. So I don't know what the empirical evidence, but I would suggest that it might not be the case that you say to yourself, oh, there was a hurricane, let me fear another one and move. Instead, all of a sudden, the connection to the community and the particular house and the memories and so on might actually become stronger.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
The middle class is at the forefront of this year's presidential election, as it is in most elections. And for good reason, middle class prosperity is the biggest influence on the overall health of the economy. Both candidates take every opportunity to address how they'll strengthen the middle class, especially with so many of those households struggling. But to understand how the middle class ended up in such a mess, you have to examine a long history of decline. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Hedrick Smith does that in his new book, Who Stole the American Dream? Welcome to the program.
It's nice to be with you, Tess.
You know, I think everyone in this country, including politicians on both sides of the aisle, agrees that the middle class is very important in this country. So why haven't we been able to save it?
Well, because we've been doing a whole lot of things that have been hurting it. CEOs of companies thought it was their job to sustain and support the interests and balance the interests of the various stakeholders in the company. And that word stakeholders is very important. It's not shareholders alone, mm-hmm. but it's management, it's employees, it's suppliers, it's customers, it's the communities they lived in. As productivity in the American economy went up, so did the pay of the average person in America. That has not been true since 1973.
Well, let's talk about how this came to be, because as you mentioned, the early 70s seemed to be a big turning point. And that, I mean, that was 40 years ago. So we're looking at quite a long history. What happened at that point?
Well, what happened was two things. One of them, wedge economics, the wedge that split the middle class workers off from their share of American prosperity, from the profits of American companies. But something else happened then, and there was a tremendous power shift in the late 1970s in Washington, which has led to a consistent policy tilt on behalf of corporations, on behalf of the corporate elite and the financial elite in this country. You had a revolt by the bosses, so to speak. A memo from Lewis Powell, who was named to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon back in 1971, said literally that the American free enterprise system was in mortal danger and that the business leaders were the forgotten people in Washington. And he said, you've got to exercise, you've got to organize, put your money where your mouth is, and flex your muscles. And we saw a bunch of things happen. Labor laws that labor wanted to pass and consumer laws that consumer wanted to pass, we saw them blocked in that 1978 Congress. The 401k plan got started. The corporate bankruptcy laws got changed to the advantage of corporate management. The lid was blown off interest rates, which really favored Wall Street and the banks. And the tax, the capital gains tax rate, excuse me, was cut from 48% to 28%, and the corporate tax rate was lowered. That's the first time that had happened since the New Deal. Business found out in that Congress we could win. We could get what we wanted. We tasted power and we wanted more of it. And that's been the case ever since.
You talk several times in the book about the shift from the pension system to the 401k. And that's something that, of course, comes up on this program regularly because people are so baffled by how they are supposed to manage their own retirements.
It has been a disaster. You can't build a retirement system. You can't build a retirement nest egg if you don't plunk the money away every year. But people can't do that. They can't discipline themselves. They're not smart about the market. There are people who've done well, but it's a small minority, and it's almost always the minority that's already making more money and has a better education and knows something about the market. And that is, at least in my estimation, that is one of the big thefts of the middle class dream. Hundreds of billions of dollars of annual expenditures have been taken off the company books and they've been put on the shoulders of individuals.
Given that it has taken 40 years for us to get to this point, what can the middle class do to A, help itself, and B, try to get some sort of agreement in this country on how to accomplish that?
Well, it's not going to be a quick fix. There are some fairly obvious things that need to be done. We have a tax system today that rewards companies for moving jobs overseas. 78 of the biggest companies in America made billions and billions of dollars of profits in 2008, 2009, 2010 and paid zero taxes. In fact, some of them got money back. General Motors got a rebate from the federal government of $4.5 billion. Mm-hmm. This hyper-concentration of wealth and hyper-concentration of political power, super PACs, lobbyists in Washington, goes hand in hand. The only way to counteract that is for people to get organized. And the evidence shows that when the people speak and organize, Washington actually listens. Politicians are afraid of organized people. The system's not going to fix itself. It's just only going to change when the public insists that it do that.
And I guess the question still is why that has not happened yet. Because there does seem to be so much disaffection. And people are angry.
There's going to be some day where some of those people who are foreclosed are going to say, okay, this isn't fair. My God, look what happened. I mean, the banks had to admit that in hundreds and thousands of cases, they had the paperwork all screwed up. Mm-hmm. They had to pay $25 billion to the state's attorneys general to kind of hush up the screw up in the foreclosures. That's outrageous. And people should be outraged and people should respond to that. But until people do, the banks are going to keep doing what they're doing and the politicians are going to keep doing what they're doing. At some point here, I think there's going to be a change. Watch one date in particular, August 28th, 2013. That is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Right here on this program, I'm going to predict there's going to be another March on Washington. I hope there's something that happens before that, but I will bet you on that day there'll be a lot of ordinary people in Washington saying something's rotten in the state of Denmark, and it ain't just the cheese.
Hedrick Smith is the author of Who Stole the American Dream? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tess. I appreciate your interest.
And Hedrick and I spoke for quite a while. If you'd like to hear the full interview, go to marketplace.org. The government program formerly known as food stamps is the subject of some attention this election cycle. Today, nearly 47 million Americans are enrolled in the program. Conservatives say that is too many.
Food stamps versus paychecks.
Today, 47 million people are on food stamps.
We spend all that money, and what do we have to show for it?
But it's much more than a political issue. It is a personal one. Shireen Marisol Meraji has been talking to people about food stamps, and she joins us now in the studio. Hi there.
Hi, Tess.
So you spoke with a lot of folks who receive this federal food assistance. What are they saying about essentially being targeted this election cycle?
Most of the people I spoke with said they feel like the food stamp recipient is the new poster child for a bad economy and for too much government spending rather than, you know, being human beings with financial problems. One of these people that I spoke with, her name is Andrea Waterstreet. She describes herself like this.
I'm a 44-year-old ex-waitress who is disabled.
Andrea comes from a solid middle-class background, but got too sick to work in 2008. She lived off unemployment insurance, and when it ran out, she signed up for food stamps. She said that she was really nervous about talking to the media about her situation.
I'm, you know, out here saying I'm poor, but at the same time, I don't think it's anything that's dishonorable.
I think all this talk about food stamps during the election has made people less willing to be open. It was really hard for me to get people to give me their first and last names and talk on tape about their situation.
I think that's pretty understandable. You know, the program became SNAP back in 2008, kind of in an effort to rebrand it so you wouldn't have this kind of, stamp, I guess, on people who are using it. Has the current administration changed the perception of government food aid because of that name change?
Well, first of all, SNAP stands for something, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Right.
And the federal government created commercials and PSAs to, you know, get the SNAP name for people to sort of recognize it. And let's hear one of those.
Did you know millions of Americans with low income can get help buying food? Introducing SNAP. It helps you eat right when money's tight.
Wait, excuse me. Did you say SNAP?
Yes. SNAP is the new name for the federal food stamp program.
At least they rhyme. Eat right when money's tight.
Right. So, you know, that's sort of the government's way of trying to erase the stigma.
Sure.
But I think there's still mixed feelings about whether it's changed the perception of food stamps. I don't think people who use the program are out there advertising, hey, I'm on food stamps.
Sure.
Look at me.
Well, you also spoke to a conservative economist who says that the stigma is decreasing and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, I spoke to an economist. His name is Paul Gregory from the Hoover Institution, which is a conservative think tank. And he said the government is doing all it can to erase the stigma of government dependency. He says all the advertisements and the PSAs are troubling because Americans are starting to look to the government first to meet their basic needs rather than being resourceful and going to local charities and to nonprofits.
So in other words, this notion that if it doesn't make you feel bad about being on food stamps, that you're just going to not try to get off of them.
Yeah. Exactly. And he says that makes us a less productive society, and that's not good for the economy. And then I went to a food bank here in L.A., and I ran into someone, his name is Scott Wilderman, who really echoed that sentiment. He volunteers at his church and was picking up food for his church pantry when we spoke.
Actually, the more people that you give food stamps to, the less people come to the church for food because they're getting it from the government. Food stamps is socialism. We're not a socialist country.
And this is from someone who was actually helping hand out the food.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, food stamps certainly aren't the only government safety net program. Why do you think Governor Romney and his running mate, Congressman Ryan, have focused so much attention on this particular program this election.
Because I think everybody knows what food stamps are. Yeah. Everybody knows who uses them, what they're for. So if you're trying to make the point that government spends all this money on programs and what do we have to show for it, it's much easier to use food stamps as an example than the other social safety net programs that are out there. For example, like the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit that eats up a much bigger chunk of the government budget than food stamps do.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So,
but they're harder to explain.
Exactly. So it's Medicaid. It's these tax credits, then it's food stamps. But bringing up food stamps is sort of an easy in to the big debate this election, which is what's the role government should play in our lives? Is it a big role or is it a small role?
All right. Great tape there. Thanks so much, Shireen.
You're welcome.
Shireen Marisol Meraji is a reporter on the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk. Arizona looks as though it will vote Governor Mitt Romney's way next week. Polls say he has an 8-point lead there. A lot of his support comes from senior citizens who have flocked to the state and its capital, Phoenix. The city's suburbs are like one big retirement community, sun-kissed and lined with golf courses. But baby boomers are beginning to change things. Many are thumbing their noses at the burbs and moving into the heart of the city. Peter O'Dowd reports on why some are spending their golden years downtown.
Downtown Phoenix just got another 60 housing units for seniors. Just before the grand opening, I talked with Gorman & Company developer Brian Swanton on the balcony of one of those units as construction crews below power washed the walls.
Quite frankly, it's all driven by economics.
The lofts at McKinley were partially financed by a group of nonprofits and set aside for low and middle income residents 55 years and older. The complex is a few blocks from a light rail station, and most importantly, it's close to jobs. Swanton says fewer seniors can afford to retire early, and almost no one has guaranteed pensions anymore.
Folks in their 60s today are not in that same situation, so the economics have driven them into a different housing prototype.
Nearly 300 affordable housing units for seniors will be available along Phoenix's still burgeoning light rail line by the end of 2013. It may not sound like much. Swanton says his company has built projects like this in Miami and Chicago for years. But in Phoenix, not so much.
This is a new concept. Bringing seniors into the downtown urban core is sort of a whole new dynamic.
For an indication of how this might actually work, we can travel a few miles down the rail line. About 5 months ago, Joel Cohen and his neighbor Pam Wells moved into the latest urban senior development in Tempe.
Coming. I can't walk as fast as everybody else, but I'm trying.
You're doing a good job, honey. A good job.
Pam, I didn't know you were behind me.
Cohen has a vascular condition that limits his walking. Those are his keys jangling on a lanyard around his neck. He just turned 60.
And it was a horrifying experience.
Outside the elevator near their second floor apartments, Cohen and Wells say the $400 subsidized monthly rent is the first reason they moved here.
I have nothing except my pride and my dignity, and I'm not afraid to say that I take advantage of every program out there that I can get my hands on for a disabled individual.
This was the determining factor. This is what made me decide to quit my job, pack my clothes, leave my furniture, and come here.
Wells moved from St. Louis to be closer to her children. She says she couldn't afford to live in a suburban single-family home. Just like Cohen, every penny of her $1,000 Social Security check goes out the door each month. Now her car is breaking down, and fixing it costs Wells money.
I drive a PT Cruiser, a Chrysler PT Cruiser, which I love, and I have a really close connection with, but I am thinking about just giving it up.
And does living here help you make that decision financially because you live now near this transit node?
Oh, without a doubt.
Advocates of urban senior housing say giving up the car can save nearly $9,000 a year. But for most people in the Phoenix area, going without a car is almost unheard of. Cohen says he's proof Wells doesn't need that PT Cruiser. His disability prevents him from driving, so he rides the train, he takes the bus, and he uses a motorized scooter to explore the neighborhood where rowdy college kids dip in and out of bars.
For me, being close to the younger generation was very important. I liked being in a college town. I like to see all the craziness and the zaniness. It makes me feel young again.
And if Cohen tires of the college scene, he won't need to go far. The 56-unit complex is completely leased out, all with people his own age. In Tempe, Arizona, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
While we're talking about senior citizens, we should probably talk Social Security. It's the largest government program in the world. And at more than 20% of our national budget, it's what the government spends most of our money on. So it's no wonder politicians like to promise to reform Social Security. Commentator Chris Farrell says, unfortunately, both candidates' plans are way too complicated.
When the election is over, Washington will quickly turn to dealing with the debt and the deficit. Well, fighting over it again, at least. Among the most heated topics will be Social Security and how to shore up its strained finances for the long haul. Social Security is the financial foundation for most retirees. Yet married couples have 567 options for deciding when and how to file for their Social Security benefits. Let me repeat that. 567 options. Single people have 9. All the twists and wrinkles mean there are plenty of potential pitfalls. Fill in the paperwork the wrong way and at the wrong time, and you'll end up with a smaller monthly income for life. Social Security calculators are springing up all over the web to help people. But they are nothing more than a web aid. The Social Security program is just too complicated. Of course, the program has to take into account divorce, spousal benefits, and so on. As Albert Einstein wisely remarked, make things as simple as possible, but not any simpler. Still, simplification would make a real difference in the lives of America's future retirees.
Chris Farrell is a senior economics correspondent for Marketplace. When you think of Medicare beneficiaries, you probably think of senior citizens, and they do account for nearly all the 49 million Americans on the program. But as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington, Medicare also has millions of indirect, unexpected beneficiaries.
All right, she's the slowest.
Every morning, Jeff Gordon takes his dad, Albert, to an adult daycare center in Washington called Iona Senior Services. The staff calls Albert Mr. G.
He's now 101 years old, going on 102. He'll be 102 in February.
Jeff moved his dad here from Detroit 4 years ago to live with him and his wife. Albert, like anyone who's lived a century, sees a lot of doctors. An internist, a cardiologist, a dermatologist, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, a podiatrist. And then there's the occasional unplanned visit. All that medical care is expensive. Jeff says the cost for this year alone is at least $18,000.
It's outrageous. I mean, to have a podiatrist to clip his nails, that's $150. And if he goes into the hospital, you're talking $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 just for a visit to find out what happened.
Jeff's mother-in-law is 93, and she also lives with him. Last year, doctors discovered she had a tumor. She spent 10 days in intensive care, then another week and a half in the hospital.
That bill must have been $100,000. And I don't care how much money you save for retirement, $100,000 goes pretty fast in the healthcare system.
Jeff says Medicare has made it possible for him to care for her and for his dad, whose annual income from Social Security is just over $16,000.
If he wasn't on Medicare and we had to cover all of these costs out of pocket, not only would it bankrupt him, but it would probably bankrupt us as well.
Medicare's architects had that in mind when they came up with the program. Jonathan Oberlander teaches public health at UNC Chapel Hill.
Medicare was designed as an intergenerational program to help retirees, but also to help their children by sparing them from the costs and the burden of paying for their parents' medical care.
Democratic Congressman John Dingell helped vote Medicare into law in 1965. and he remembers what elder care used to be like in the days before Medicare.
Well, it was pretty grim. Senior citizens were dependent either on charity or on their kids.
Back then, insurers wouldn't offer coverage to seniors because they were seen as too high risk. David Rosner is a professor of public health at Columbia. He says that when it came to paying for an aging parent's medical care, children faced a tough choice.
It was either going to come out directly of your pocket, or alternatively, you're going to have to abandon your mom and pop.
Marilyn Moon is a healthcare economist, and I asked her how she'd quantify how much Medicare has helped people like Jeff Gordon, who care for older parents.
Think about the cost right now. If you tried to buy Medicare on the open market, you would have to pay around $10,000 to $11,000.
Per year. That's maybe five times what a healthy middle-aged American pays.
So that means that if you were a family trying to help out your mother or your grandmother, that would be a substantial chunk of resources.
Last year, Medicare spent nearly $400 billion to provide health care for seniors. That also represents nearly $400 billion in savings that seniors and their families could use to spend on other things. The typical senior lives on about $22,000 a year, and John Oberlander at UNC says that's why most Americans see Medicare as essential.
The fact that the government is there, that we as a society are there to pool together and pay for them together as a community is a tremendous help to families, because those younger families, were it not for Medicare, they would be the ones who would be left holding the bills.
And trying to find a way to pay them. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
President Obama and Governor Romney have spent a lot of time talking about jobs and the economy, but here's one related subject that hasn't gotten much attention. That part of your life when you hope to quit your job and enter the leisure economy, also known as retirement. Commentator Helene Olin says we should all be asking more questions about whether retirement will soon be a long-gone piece of the American dream.
We're on the verge of a retirement crisis in this country. It's something pretty much everyone knows, except apparently the two guys running for president. Pensions are rapidly becoming a thing of the past, and the private savings schemes that have taken their place are not working out as planned. Most Americans have less than $100,000 in their 401ks, and that's not going to change anytime soon, since about half of us live paycheck to paycheck. We can hardly save for an emergency tomorrow, never mind something that's going to happen 20 years from now. In addition, stock market returns have been anemic for more than a decade. So even those few who have saved money are not seeing the gains financial advisors promised. But the presidential candidates don't talk about this. Instead, they discuss, as President Obama put it, tweaking Social Security, a program vital to seniors. The Census Bureau reports an additional 20 million Americans over 65 would live in poverty if not for their Social Security checks. Politicians are fond of bashing Social Security as a major source of our budgetary woes. During the Bush administration, Mitt Romney's running mate, Paul Ryan, supported a proposal to turn a portion of our Social Security funds over to Wall Street, an idea that proved about as popular as paroling Charles Manson. The current Social Security meme, popular with deficit hawks, calls for raising the age we can claim benefits. More Americans say they want to work longer, but no one has proven the jobs will be there for them to do that. Nor is it clear we will be capable of performing them. Studies show baby boomers are less healthy than their parents at the same age. No wonder so many of us are scared, with surveys finding about 80% petrified about how we will get by when our paid work lives end. And that number will likely go up every time someone tells us they plan to tweak Social Security.
Helene Olin is a contributor for Forbes and author of the forthcoming book, Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Even with all the warnings about the importance of saving for retirement, more and more people are raiding those funds for other purposes. They're using 401ks and IRAs for things like new business startups, purchasing rental property, and private equity investment. An entire industry has sprung up around accessing retirement funds early. Financial companies are advertising that they can help you make money off investing your retirement money tax-free. Stephen Davidoff writes the Deal Professor column for the New York Times, and he wrote this week about the risks involved in allowing people to use retirement money for, well, anything but retirement. Welcome.
Good day.
We say all the time on this program, of course, that it is never a good idea to raid your retirement funds. But, you know, there are a few exceptions. You know, if you are having trouble making ends meet, if you're perhaps looking to buy a first home. But this is something different entirely. So what are these folks doing now?
In one version, they're rolling over their 401k, starting a company, creating a new 401k, and funding their new business with their retirement.
And is this something fairly new?
It's not new. It's been around for a few years. But if you've flown an airline in the last few months, you've seen now that they're advertising this. Hmm. Bored with your business, bored with your job, start a new job, use your retirement funds.
And where does this all go wrong then?
Well, it all goes wrong because, as we know, starting a business is a risky endeavor. And using your retirement funds for it can leave you nothing. The businesses that have started, the IRS found that most have actually failed using this technique. Some may be as successful as Mitt Romney's use of his IRA, but most are not.
How did he use his IRA?
Oh, fantastically, Tess. Essentially, he put in about, we're not sure the exact numbers, but about $500,000 more or less, and was able to deposit his private equity investments into his IRA. And he's turned $500,000 into estimated $20 million to $100 million, all tax-free.
Wow. Well, why can't the rest of us do that then?
We can. If you go to work for a private equity firm and they're willing to allow you to invest through their IRAs, and in fact, you can do many types of investment through your IRAs. If you want to buy gold, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
People buy cattle, real estate. There's one man who actually had a musical instrument rental business running out of his IRA.
I think that there are some people out there who think of their 401k not just as a retirement fund, but as just a savings vehicle, that somehow it is different from, say, the money that was set aside in the old-fashioned pension. Do you think there's something behaviorally going on here?
Absolutely. People like to speculate. We saw this during the tech bubble when people were day trading their IRAs, mm-hmm. their 401ks. That didn't work out very well. And second, what we're seeing is herd behavior. People, they follow the herd. And so if you watch Fox News, if you watch certain TV shows, there's a lot of gold ads. So people are piling in, speculating through their IRAs. And I think, Tess, there's a third problem with this, which is that this is all tax-free. So for many people, it just won't work out. But if there's gains, they can be spectacular, and that's money that, frankly, is sheltered from taxes and probably not what the people who developed IRAs or 401ks meant to give a tax benefit to, right? We were having a contest in my office yesterday trying to name the most fun thing we could invest our IRAs in, and I came up with buffalo.
Oh, no.
It's such a great image, right? Your IRA is sitting there in an account. You look at a number, but it's actually a herd of buffalo.
Okay.
It's not meant to be this speculative vehicle. It's meant to be there 30 years from now. But if you're going to do it through a retirement plan, perhaps we should think about whether that should be allowed or not.
Well, what kind of regulations are there on these businesses that are now encouraging people to take money out of retirement and funnel it into some new business?
None that I know of. Mm. The IRS investigated these plans earlier in 2009, one form of them. And actually, one of the schemes to use your 401k or IRA to start a business is called a ROBS plan, ironically enough, the rollover for business startups. And you really can't make this stuff up. And the IRS looked at it, found that many of these businesses failed. In fact, most of these businesses failed, but did nothing more than say, we're going to scrutinize them to make sure they follow the strict IRS regulations to do this. And it's very intricate. It's very hard to do. You often need an IRS letter. And study after study has found that the general person on the street just isn't Mitt Romney.
Stephen Davidoff is an associate professor of law and finance at Ohio State University and author of the Deal Professor column in the New York Times. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Words from a couple of voters. And by the way, if I may say, if you don't vote, you don't get to complain. We have opposing views from both sides of the political fence. First, from Andy Kindler. He's a stand-up comedian, and he's casting his ballot for, well, I'll let him speak for himself.
Hi, I'm Andy Kindler. The opinions you are about to hear are mine. I'm not channeling anyone that I'm aware of. I'm not a medium. Also, I'm no newsman. I'm a comedian. I'm biased and I have an agenda. Election day is almost here and still I'm undecided. Should I vote for Obama by mail or in person? Should I despise Romney or just dislike him intensely? Is it better to shun my Republican friends or simply vilify them? If a tree falls in the forest, would Dick Cheney shoot it? Also, is Dick Cheney still a current reference? What is the sound of one hand suppressing a vote? This race is coming down to the wire, and I don't understand why. The only votes Romney should get are from the severely rich. If you're a member of this group, I get it. You want more tax breaks. Maybe you need a fifth yacht in case your other four yachts are in the shop. But why would anybody else vote for Romney? Is America looking for someone who has no core convictions? Are they impressed by a man who can change his positions without changing his facial expression? Romney has refused to release several years of his tax returns. I guess he's going after the people who also have something to hide vote. There are some who may actually be attracted to his flip-flopping. They think, well, I don't agree with him now, but maybe he'll change his mind. I still predict that Obama will win. I remain confident about this, and I've never been wrong, except for Carter in 80, Mondale in 84, Dukakis in 88, and several other elections. But keep this in mind. If you don't vote for Obama, I will personally be disappointed in you. And I'm not crazy about you now. So don't push it. I'm Andy Kindler, and I approve this message. I also wrote it, so that's not really surprising. I also thought my delivery was excellent.
L.A. comedian Andy Kindler, in case you missed his name the three times he said it. President Obama is well known for his ability to connect with young people, his apparently effortless charm and perfect pitch. Comedy writer Brian Donovan admits the president has all of that and more, but those aren't necessarily assets he values as a voter.
This was the moment where I officially gave up on President Obama.
20 years ago, I became the luckiest man on earth because Michelle Obama agreed to marry me.
Really? Mr. President, I don't need to know when your anniversary is. I don't even know when my anniversary is, mostly because my girlfriend is imaginary. But what I do need to know is why I should vote for you. Look, Barack Obama is cool. He's never in a rush, and he looks great in a pair of blue jeans. When Mitt Romney puts on blue jeans, he looks about as comfortable as a rhinoceros. But I don't care. I don't need a cool guy. I need a dorky guy who's got a bunch of dorky sons who spent most of his dorky life in front of a calculator figuring out how to make a ton of dorky money. Because that guy gets stuff done. Here's what critics say about Mitt. They say he will change, he will twist, he will alter. He's like Gumby except a Mormon and with more gel in his hair. But I'm okay with that. He wants to win and he'll do whatever it takes. Obama spent 4 years trying to build consensus and didn't win much of anything. We've already had a lackluster four-year relationship with the president. Now it looks like we might break up with him and he's making a lot of promises. But we all know what happens when you get back together with an ex. It starts out great and then in 2 weeks they're back to stealing money from your wallet and hooking up with your best friend. Or maybe that's just me. But the point is, we know what we're going to get from Mr. Obama. Charm, inspiration, and mediocre results. So maybe it's time we give the other guy a shot, because we know he'll fight dirty, and I'd rather see 4 more years of that than 4 more years of happy anniversaries.
Brian Donovan lives and writes in Los Angeles. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. And people, go out and vote this week. Next time, in honor of Veterans Day, how some former soldiers injured in the line of duty are finding their way back to meaningful work lives.
Since I was 17, I've been in the military, and all I've been doing is serving my country. And just because I'm hurt doesn't mean I want to stop doing that. It's just I have to figure out a different way to do it.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Mary Dew. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.